Numbers, Chapters 1 and 2. The first talk in a series on Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on August 12, 2018, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 1, Numbers 1 and 2, accompanies this talk.
Okay, I've decided to do Numbers. It was my next book of the Bible. I thought about other possibilities, but I decided that it'd probably be best to continue right where I left off in Exodus and proceed into Numbers. So that's what I'm going to do. And looking at a commentary on Numbers, it said that Numbers is the most neglected book in the Old Testament. There's stiff competition for that. I read in another commentary that Leviticus claims to be, the commentator said it's the most neglected book in the Old Testament. And then I was looking at Ezra and Nehemiah, and the commentator there made the same claim. So there are a lot of neglected books in the Old Testament. But there is a reason for that claim with respect to Numbers. It's a weird book. It's strangely organized. It's hard to figure out why the things that are in there are in there. So that's part of the challenge that Numbers presents to us. A number of years ago, I started going through the books of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. And I did Genesis, I did Exodus, and I did Numbers, and then I went on to Joshua. But I'm redoing those now. When I did them a number of years ago, I was primarily focused on the history. I wanted to understand what is the history of the people of Israel. Where did they come from, and how have they developed, and why? And that was a helpful project for me personally, just to get that stuff sorted out. But more recently, I'm approaching these same books in a different way, and that is to say that when I went through them before, I would sometimes skip sections if it was not historical narrative. So in Exodus, I skipped a number of chapters when I did it years ago. I did the same thing in Numbers. I skipped some chapters where there wasn't any historical narrative. This time, I'm not skipping those chapters. I want to look at each book as a piece of literature, not as a history book. And I'll explain why, and I'm going to take some time to explain why, and then after my introductory comments, I'll open it up for questions before I start into chapter 1 of the book. What I'm trying to do in my own mind is I would like to become culturally literate with respect to ancient Israelite culture. Now let me explain what that means. There was a book that came out in the early 80s by E.D. Hirsch called Cultural Literacy. It was a very controversial book. What he was arguing is that it is very important for a culture, and he was talking about American culture, but it's very important for the people in that culture to be culturally literate. And what he meant by that is it's important for them to all have a good understanding of the writings, the values, the thought patterns of the culture in which you live. Why is that important? Because it is a uniting, it is a unifying force. It's something that everyone shares in common, and it facilitates communication. It's like having a shared language, but now it's a cultural language. It's a shared cultural language, and it facilitates understanding in communication. One of the examples he used in his book is the Gettysburg Address. It used to be that everybody in school memorized the Gettysburg Address. And everybody knew very well what the contents of that speech are. And as a result then, in conversation, one could just allude to the Gettysburg Address and the listener would know immediately what that allusion was, what the person was talking about. And so what Hirsch was arguing is it makes communication much better. It makes it easier for us to communicate our ideas to our fellow cultural citizen. And those ideas are richer. They're fuller. They're more complete as a result of that. He lost the argument. We have moved not in the direction of cultural literacy. We're celebrating diversity instead. But it was an interesting book that he wrote, and I think very compelling. What I would like to do is, to the extent that it is possible, given the fact that Israel was a long time ago, I would like as much as possible to recreate in my mind the cultural literacy of Israelite culture. And so that's what I'm as I go through the books now, that's more what I'm looking for. I'm not as much looking for just history. I'm trying to understand the world the way that they understood it. I'm trying to understand the stories that they told each other and why they told them and what meaning came with that. And what are the thought patterns that were used to communicate their ideas one to another? All of that is much more interesting to me now. It's much more important to me now because I understand how integral that is to the way that we communicate. And therefore, one needs to understand, one needs to be culturally literate in Israelite culture in order to understand what they're saying and why they're saying it. So now, things like the tabernacle and what's in the tabernacle, how it's made, what are all the symbols that are around, that's much more important to me than it used to be. The laws, even the laws with respect to what's clean and what's unclean, that's much more important to me now. It's more significant to me now because they all would have understood that. They grew up with that, and it would have been part of their thinking automatically. Culture is a strange thing. It's a very strange thing. It is all pervasive. It's absolutely everywhere. It's in our thoughts. It has a huge impact on the way we see the world. And yet, we're oblivious to it for the most part. This summer was the World Cup in soccer, which is a great event. It's very interesting. Because you have the best soccer teams, you have the national soccer teams, the best national soccer teams from, what is it, 32 nations that get together and play games over a period of about a month. And one of the things that is very clear when you watch the games is the teams, the way that they play soccer reflects the culture from where they come. I mean, even that is affected by our culture. There are some teams that play, it's very ordered. It's very kind of mechanical how the players are going to move and what they're going to do. Others, it's much more artistic and free-flowing. Others, it's absolutely unpredictable. They're just, people are doing all kinds of things. There are some where clearly the goal is to win the game at all cost. But there are other cultures where there's a beauty to soccer, and if you don't play it beautifully, then winning isn't all that significant. All those values are coming from the cultures that those teams come out of. And I think one could do a study of each of those teams, and it would tell you a lot about the culture from which they come. It just affects everything. I was talking to my wife about, I was just thinking about the way you teach your children to wash dishes. I mean, do you leave the water running? Do you turn it off? Do you put the water in a bowl and wash them in a bowl? And then dump that water out and change it. Do you rinse it all? Do you just wash them and not rinse? Do you put them out and let them dry, air dry? Or do you dry them with towels so you can put them back in the cupboard so nobody can see them? All those things, those are all value-laden decisions.
What's he talking about?
Washing dishes. All those are value-laden decisions, and you pass those on to your kids without even knowing that you're doing it, and without your kids even knowing that they're doing it. The only way they know that that's happened is when they get married and they have in-laws and find out they're supposed to be done a different way. So culture just permeates everything we do, and it certainly permeates the documents that we write, the documents that codify what we believe to be true about the world. I wish it were possible to go back in time and visit ancient Israel. See it, smell it, feel it, talk to people, hear the stories that they tell each other and how they tell them. Go through the education process. See how education works. What are students taught and how are they taught those things? But that's not possible, that's not, unfortunately. So we have to, by other means, try to reconstruct as best we can what was cultural literacy in ancient Israel. So that's the method to my madness. That's what I'm interested in doing, and that's why I'm going through the books the way that I'm going through them, because I think that there are some things with respect to cultural literacy that can be gained by doing that. So I have not redone Genesis, but I did redo Exodus, and in Exodus that I just finished a few months ago, I was taking this approach, at least in my mind, that's what I've been doing. So I'm going to continue that right into Numbers. I skipped Leviticus. You're welcome. But someday I would like to come back to that. I think it's important. Okay. I am, by the way, going to try to generate an outline for each talk before I give the talk. So, and those are available if they're helpful, fine. If they aren't, that's fine. I don't guarantee that I'll stick to my outline. Okay, so that's what I am doing as I go through. I hope that you can appreciate the project and why I'm doing it this way. Learning to be culturally literate is a lot like learning a language. And learning a language is hard work. It's tedious, there's a lot of detail, and it's hard to know how the detail is going to be important later on. But as you're learning a language, you have to learn the grammar, you have to learn the vocabulary, even though the grammar and the vocabulary isn't very exciting in and of itself. It's what facilitates being able to understand and speak that language as you gain knowledge. And that will be the case with what we're going through here. It requires patience, and it requires trust in the process. And it's like we're learning some exotic language like Swahili together. It's a very foreign language, but there's another obstacle, and that is I don't speak Swahili. So we're learning it together. It's something that we're undertaking together. Okay. So we'll jump into Numbers. I'm not sure exactly what we'll find. I've worked ahead, but I still don't know what we'll find. I do know that Numbers is not action-packed, especially the first 10 chapters of Numbers. There's hardly any action. The last two-thirds of the book, there's quite a bit of historical narrative and some very interesting stories that are built into that. It is not purely historical narrative. It is a strange combination of historical narrative and then sections of the law, and it alternates back and forth. And it's not clear to me why, and that's one of the things that we'll have to deal with. It is not organized strictly by chronological order. Exodus, for the most part, was in his historical order, chronological order. But Numbers is not, and it's clear from the text that it's not. So there's some other ordering principle that is trumping strict chronology. And the organization of the book is not clear. Wellhausen called Numbers the junk drawer of the Old Testament. It's just stuff thrown together, it appears to be. That fit his understanding of how the Old Testament books came into being. He thought that they were just kind of a piece was taken from here and stuck onto a piece from another place, and a piece from another place stuck onto that. So a chaotic organization fit his understanding of how it came to be. But in recent times, fewer and fewer scholars think that that's how the books of the Old Testament came into being. And even if that's how they came into being, somehow the books as they exist exhibit a great deal of organization and coherence. And as a result, modern scholarship is looking at the Old Testament books as a unit, which is wonderful. Numbers, it's difficult to look at it as a unit. It's hard to figure out how it's organized. And in reading commentaries, I have found three different proposals as to how Numbers is organized. I'm not convinced of any of the three. They are all too complicated, it seems to me, to account for what we see. A reader would have to sit down with paper and pencil, listening and taking notes, if they are to recover the organization that all of these commentators ventured. So, it's hard to figure out what the organization is, but I'm confident that there is organization, and I'm confident that that organization is important. Because if you don't know the organization of a text, you don't know what the context of any piece of that text is. And context is critical for understanding any statement that you find in a text. So, I'm going to be dealing with organizational issues as necessary as we go through, but know that that is a problem. That is an issue that needs to be resolved at some point. What is the setting for Numbers? Numbers happens very soon after the end of Exodus. Exodus ends about a year after the Israelites left Egypt. And the date for that is depending on whether you take the high chronology or the low chronology. 1445 BC would be the high chronology. 1290 would be the low chronology as the date for when the action in Numbers begins. As you'll recall from Exodus, and Numbers is starting within a month of when Exodus ended. Leviticus all comes in that month in between. So Numbers is beginning when they are still at Mount Sinai. They haven't left there yet. So remember, they've come out of Egypt. God has brought them out of Egypt, out of slavery in Egypt, brought them through the wilderness to Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, God made a covenant with the Israelites. And he agreed to be their God, and they agreed to obey him as their God. But then, right after making the covenant, they rebel. They create the golden calf, and they worship the golden calf. So God wants to destroy them, but because of Moses' intervention, God relents, and God is fully reconciled with the people of Israel, and he comes and dwells in their midst in the tabernacle that the Israelites build. So he is right in their camp, living with them. So that's the way Exodus ends. Numbers begins just a few weeks after that. And Numbers then is going to follow them from Mount Sinai to the Promised Land, and then, spoiler alert, that doesn't go well. And for 40 years, they wander in the wilderness before they go back. And Numbers will trace those 40 years. Interestingly, Numbers has very little about the middle 38 years. Numbers talks about the first year in the wilderness while they're going to the Promised Land, and then it talks about the last year when they're moving from the desert up along the east side of the Jordan, getting ready to come into the Promised Land. So Numbers is talking about those two periods of time with very little to say about the middle 38 years. I think there are about three chapters on that middle 38 years. What is Numbers about? Exodus was about God making a people for himself. God took them out of slavery. He took them through a bunch of experiences together. He taught them. He gave them the law. He made a covenant with them. And he brings them together as a people. They are no longer just a disparate group of people, of individuals. It is a people that he creates. And he has a relationship with them. In Numbers, then, we see this people, but we see that they are not a fundamentally changed people from what they were when they first came out of Egypt. They continue to be rebellious, and we're going to see that. That rebelliousness runs very deep, and they're going to make exactly the same mistakes they had made before they got to Mount Sinai. And what we're going to see is God says, this generation has to go. I am going to wait until the next generation comes along and then lead you into the Promised Land. This generation has to die. And even Moses and his brother Aaron are going to die before they go into the promised land. Okay, let me open it up for questions, and then if there are after some questions, then we can go on to chapter one. Are there any questions?
Do any of the New Testament authors quote Numbers?
I don't know. I don't remember. I think so. There are certainly allusions to Numbers. A number of them.
Just a clarification. You said it's not historical narrative. What exactly do you mean?
By historical narrative, I mean that genre when you tell history, tell what happened.
Well, I was just looking through here. Most of the chapters start, again, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, so
right.
Even the non-event things are presented in a historical mode?
Well, it's in the framework of this historical narrative, but those sections,
right.
it's really a different genre when you get to those sections. It's a proclamation from God.
Okay.
And it's argued there are more genres in Numbers than any book of the Bible. I haven't checked that out, but that's what's argued. Any other questions? Okay, we'll start in. Numbers chapter 1. It's, by the way, the book is called Numbers because that's what it was titled in the Greek translation of the Old Testament. But that's not what it has been called in Jewish culture. It has had two names. Typically, certainly the first five books of the Old Testament are all called, referred to by the first word in the book. And then the Lord spoke is the way that this starts out. So it's, and he spoke, I think, is the Hebrew. But this book is also sometimes referred to as In the Desert. And that is a more fitting title for it because this is an account of what happened when the Israelites were in the desert. But the translator of the Bible into Greek gave the title Numbers, and that's what has stuck. There are, however, a number of censuses that are taken in Numbers. And so there are a lot of numbers, and that's probably what merited this title. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 19. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, "Take a census of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, every male, head by head, from 20 years old and upward, whoever is able to go out to war in Israel, you and Aaron shall number them by their armies. With you, moreover, there shall be a man of each tribe, each one head of his father's household. These then are the names of the men who shall be with you, who shall stand with you. Of Reuben, Elizur, the son of Sedeur. Of Simeon, Shelumiel, the son of Zurishaddai. Of Judah, Nashon, the son of Aminadab. Of Issachar, Nethanel, the son of Zuar. Of Zebulun, Eliab, the son of Helon. Of the sons of Joseph, of Ephraim, Elishama, the son of Amihud, of Manasseh, Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur, of Benjamin, Abidan, the son of Gideonai, of Dan, Ahiezer, the son of Amishadai, of Asher, Pagiel, the son of Akron, of Gad, Eliasaph, the son of Deuel, of Naphtali, Ahira, the son of Enan. These are they who were called of the congregation, the leaders of their fathers' tribes. They were the heads of divisions of Israel. So Moses and Aaron took these men who had been designated by name, and they assembled all the congregation together on the first of the second month. Then they registered by ancestry in their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, from 20 years old and upward, head by head, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So he numbered them in the wilderness of Sinai. So this is happening 12 months after they left Egypt. And this is the first day of the second month of the second year since they left. We will see later that chapters 7 through 9 occur earlier. So this is not in chronological order. The census is coming first here. It says that God spoke to Moses in the tabernacle. It says the tent of meeting. Earlier in Exodus, there was a tent of meeting which appeared to be a separate from the tabernacle. It was outside of the camp. So apparently there were two tents that existed. This tent of meeting pre-existed. It existed before the tabernacle. Then the tabernacle was built. And presumably then the tent of meeting was abandoned, and the tabernacle takes on the name of tent of meeting also. So sometimes it's called the tabernacle, and sometimes it's called the tent of meeting. So presumably then, it was in the tabernacle that God spoke to Moses. And he tells him to take a census. If you'll recall in Exodus, at the end of Exodus, a census was taken. The purpose of that census was to raise money for the construction of the tabernacle. So a half shekel was supposed to be taken from every adult male. And a census was taken for that purpose. Now a census is going to be taken, but this has a different purpose. The purpose of this census is to prepare the people of Israel for war. And that was commonplace in the ancient world. Those are the two main reasons that you took a census. One was for taxes, and the other one was for organizing for war. In this census, the number of people that is arrived at is exactly the same as the number of people in Exodus. It's 603,550. And they are just a little over a month apart, almost 2 months apart. They reach the same number. How can that be? That's pretty amazing. I suspect that it's the same census taken in two parts. That the first census, the one in Exodus, is taken for the purpose of raising money for the tabernacle. Things are all recorded, names are recorded, all that sort of thing. It is the laying the groundwork for the second census that occurs then in early in Numbers. And in the second census then, it is for finding how many men of military age there are and getting them organized. This is a comment from Ashley, one of the commentators. He says, "What does the final form of the text wish the reader to make of these two obviously related but separate censuses? They are similar in that they give totals of Israelite males 20 years of age and up, but the purpose of the two seems different. The first has a religious purpose, a levy for the tabernacle, and the second an administrative or military purpose. The technique was also different. The first census reports only the grand total. The census in Numbers 1 numbers the people by tribe, clan, and father's house, in addition to a count of individual names. That 12 leaders are appointed to help Moses and Aaron in this numbering indicates the much greater scope of this census. The total figure of the census checked with that of the earlier one, so that although these countings were distinct, they were so close in time that they were related. Data from the first were probably used in the second. They stand as two halves of one act. The religious half in Exodus and the military or administrative half in Numbers. Perhaps to remind the Israelites of the religious dimension of all life, even the supposedly administrative details, Aaron is included in the census of Numbers chapter 1. Who was to be counted? All males who are 20 years old and older. Who was to do the counting? It is Moses and Aaron with the help of the head of each tribe. So they're divided into tribes, divided into clans and families, and counted that way. The next section. Now the sons of Reuben, Israel's firstborn, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, head by head, every male from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Reuben were 46,500. Of the sons of Simeon, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, their numbered men, according to the number of names, head by head, every male from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Simeon were 59,300. Of the sons of Gad, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Gad were 45,650. Of the sons of Judah, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Judah were 74,600. Of the sons of Issachar, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Issachar were 45,400. Of the sons of Zebulun, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Zebulun was 57,400. Of the sons of Joseph, namely of the sons of Ephraim, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Ephraim were 40,500. Of the sons of Manasseh, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to their number of names, from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Manasseh were 32,200. Of the sons of Benjamin, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Benjamin were 35,400. Of the sons of Dan, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Dan were 62,700. Of the sons of Asher, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to their number of names, from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Asher were 41,500. Of the sons of Naphtali, their genealogical registration by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Naphtali were 53,400. These are the ones who were numbered, whom Moses and Aaron numbered with the leaders of Israel, 12 men, each of whom was his father's household, was of his father's household. So all of the numbered men of the house of the sons of Israel by their father's households, from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war in Israel, even all the numbered men, were 603,550. Okay, so how were they to be counted? It's obviously, someone could have made this account briefer. Ditto marks could have been used here and made this much briefer. So there's a certain amount of weight given to this just by the wordiness, just by repeating that the things that are repeated in each section. And a census appears to have been a big deal in ancient times, and it tends to mark a significant change or the start of something significant. They were counted by tribe, clan, and family. I suspect that this is not just a counting, but genealogical records are being prepared, that the genealogy of each person is being recorded and then saved. It lists the heads of the tribes. It's the 12 tribes. And then there's someone that's appointed to help with the counting of each tribe. In the book of Numbers, there are 7 times that all of the tribes of Israel are listed. In each occasion, there are 12 tribes listed. They aren't always the same 12 tribes. I suspect that 12 is necessary, that it's important in the telling of the story that there always be 12 tribes in Israel. Notice that we have 12 tribes, but we don't have the Levites in the 12. How did we get the 12 then? Well, we get the 12 from the 2 half-tribes of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. That's how we get the 12. And I think that's necessary in order for it to come out to 12, that there's something symbolically significant about the fact that there are 12 tribes in Israel. The order in which the tribes are giving varies in numbers. Usually the order of the tribes, as we go on further, is the order in which they march as they go through the wilderness. But that's not the case here. It's a different order. And I'm not sure why this order is used here. Generally speaking, the order is legitimate children from Leah, legitimate children from Rachel, and then children from the concubines. And those can be in various orders. That's talking about the Old Testament in general. The Levites are not listed as a tribe here because this is a military census, and the Levites will not serve in the military. They have a different purpose. This is clearly a military census that's being taken. Ashley says, the least that can be said is that the pattern used for this census was a military pattern. Israel is being prepared for war, and I'll have comments about that at the end. And in all likelihood, they are not just counting men. They are also organizing as a military force. As we get on further into Numbers, we will have a census of the Levites. But then it becomes very clear when it's talking about the Levites that when the census is taken, they are also organized and each person is assigned a task to be done. I assume that the same thing is happening in this census. It's not just counting soldiers, it's also giving out assignments with respect to when they go to warfare, when they go to war. Okay. The numbers that are used are big. And that's problematic. I talked about this in Exodus, and this issue has come up in other books of the Old Testament. And others have looked at this. If it's true that the number of men in Israel at this time was 603,550, to get the total population, you have to multiply that number by 4. And if you multiply that by 4, you get a big number. We're talking a couple million people. And if there were 2 million people making their way through the wilderness and making their way into Canaan, the biggest problem that I run into is, why are they afraid of the Canaanites? They've got 2 million people. If a fourth of them die in an attack, there's still way more than there are Canaanites in the land. So there are, and others have pointed out other reasons why these very big numbers don't seem to fit with the text itself. So I'm not just talking about a subjective response, oh, that seems like a big number. No, that number is so big, it's hard to reconcile it with other facts in the text itself. So I am inclined to think that there is some kind of problem with these big numbers. Ashley goes through and gives several reasons. He gives 5 more reasons why the text itself seems to indicate that these numbers are too large. Ashley gives several possible explanations for why these numbers are so large. One is, it's possible that the numbers are literal and they are accurate. If that's the case, then God provided for the people of Israel super miraculously to provide them with enough water, with the manna, with everything else. They would have been like locusts moving through the Sinai. It's possible that the numbers represent what Israel became later. So these tribes grew to these numbers at some point later. A third possibility is that the numbers are gematria. I don't know much about gematria. You take the numbers were written with letters from the alphabet. And in gematria, those numbers become symbolic of something, and you can somehow put that together into a symbolic meaning. So some have suggested that that is what's going on. Gematria becomes quite common in the first century AD in Jewish culture. We know that. But whether it was common earlier than that, we don't know. Another possibility is that Eleph is being used with a different meaning. Eleph means 1,000. But Eleph can also mean a clan. And Eleph can also mean a military unit, like a platoon or something. And so where it says 1,000, if it means a clan, that could be less than 1,000. Or if it meant a military unit, that could be also much less than 1,000. And that was the option that I was leaning towards when I was going through Exodus, but I have... it seems to me that's problematic, and I'm abandoning my support of that particular way of taking it. It's also possible that the numbers are symbolic, and it's been suggested that they are related to astrological phenomena. It's also been suggested that the numbers are purposely hyperbolic. They are inflated on purpose to make a point. I don't like any of those options. And at this point, my thinking is that somehow big numbers in the ancient texts, they got messed up in the transmission. And it could be that something happened and people lost track of how you even understand them, and began to misunderstand them. But something odd has happened with respect to numbers in the Old Testament, it seems to me. But that's the best I can do. I don't have a good solution to the problem. Okay, and just one other comment with respect to this census, and that is that the number of people in the tribes is interesting in that Judah is the largest, and Judah is going to become important later on in the history of Israel. The smallest are Manasseh and Benjamin, and Benjamin gets swallowed up by Judah fairly early on, and Manasseh doesn't become a prominent tribe either. So Judah's big already, and Benjamin's small already at this point in time. All right, the rest of chapter 1. The Levites, however, were not numbered among them by their father's tribe. For the Lord had spoken to Moses, saying, "Only the tribe of Levi you shall not number, nor shall you take their census among the sons of Israel. But you shall appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, and over all its furnishings, and over all that belongs to it. They shall carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings, and they shall take care of it. They shall also camp around the tabernacle. So when the tabernacle is to set out, the Levites shall take it down. And when the tabernacle encamps, the Levites shall set it up. But the layman who comes near shall be put to death, and the sons of Israel shall camp, each man by his own camp, and each man by his own standard according to their armies. But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the sons of Israel. So the Levites shall keep charge of the tabernacle of the testimony. Thus the sons of Israel did according to all which the Lord had commanded Moses, so they did." So Levites were not included in the census. The Levites are not going to have military duties. Instead, the Levites have a special obligation, and that is they are going to take care of the tabernacle. They're going to set it up, they're going to take it down, and they're going to transport it. They are also going to guard it. So those are their two main jobs. One is setting up, taking down, moving, and the other is guarding it. And it says, "But the layman who comes near shall be put to death." So if anyone, we're going to see how the camp is set up, and the Levites are around the tabernacle, and it's their job to be a buffer between the tabernacle and everybody else. And if a non-Levite tries to go through to the tabernacle, then that person is to be put to death. Jacob Milgram makes an interesting point with respect to that. He says, this is not punishment. If someone is going to the tabernacle who is not authorized to go to the tabernacle, he's to be put to death, not as punishment, but as a way of making sure it doesn't happen. That it cannot happen that an unauthorized person, and a common person, goes into the tabernacle. He also points out, and it says that the reason is 53, "But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the sons of Israel." So the the reason is to prevent the wrath of God coming down on the people. Because that's what would happen if a common person were to go to the tabernacle when he's not supposed to. Okay. Chapter 2, verses 1 through, I'll read the whole, almost the whole chapter. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, "The sons of Israel shall camp, each by his own standard, with the banners of their father's household. They shall camp around the tent of meeting at a distance. Now those who camp on the east side toward the sunrise shall be of the standard of the camp of Judah by their armies and the leader of the sons of Judah. Nahshon, the son of Amminadab, and his army, even their numbered men, 74,600, and those who camp next to him shall be the tribe of Issachar and the leader of the sons of Issachar. Nethanel, the son of Zuar, with his army, even their numbered men, 54,400. Then comes the tribe of Zebulun and the leader of the sons of Zebulun. Eliab, the son of Helon, and his army, even his numbered men, 57,400. The total of the numbered men of the camp of Judah, 186,400 by their armies. They shall set out first. On the south side shall be the standard of the camp of Reuben by their armies and the leader of the sons of Reuben. Eleazar, the son of Shedeur, and his army, even their numbered men, 46,500. And those who camp next to him shall be the tribe of Simeon. And the leader of the sons of Simeon, Shelumiel, the son of Zurishaddai, and his army, even their numbered men, 59,300. Then comes the tribe of Gad and the leader of the sons of Gad. Eliasaph, the son of Deuel, and his army, even their numbered men, 45,650. The total of the numbered men of the camp of Reuben, 151,450 by their armies, and they shall set out second. Then the tent of meeting shall set out with the camp of Levites in the midst of the camps. Just as they camp, so they shall set out, every man in his place by their standards. On the west side shall be the standard of the camp of Ephraim by their armies, and the leader of the sons of Ephraim shall be Elishama, the son of Amihud, and his army. Even their numbered men, 40,500, and next to him shall be the tribe of Manasseh, and the leader of the tribes of Manasseh, Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur, and his army, even their numbered men, 32,300. Then comes the tribe of Benjamin, and the leader of the sons of Benjamin, Abidan, the son of Gideoni, and his army, even their numbered men, 35,400. The total of the numbered men of the camp of Ephraim, 108,100 by their armies, and they shall set out third. On the north side shall be the standard of the camp of Dan by their armies, and the leader of the sons of Dan, Ahiezer, the son of Amishaddai, and his army, even their numbered men, 62,700. And those who camp next to him shall be the tribe of Asher, and the leader of the sons of Asher, Pagiel, the son of Akron, and his army, even their numbered men, 41,500. Then comes the tribe of Naphtali, and the leader of the sons of Naphtali, Ahira, the son of Enan, and his army, even their numbered men, 53,400. The total of the numbered men of the camp of Dan was 157,600. They shall set out last by their standards. So here is described the camp, and I don't have a map, but imagine a map up here of the camp. And on the east side, then, is going to be Judah. It's Judah and two other tribes. Which are the other two tribes? Issachar and Zebulun. So those three tribes are at the east side. That's the side where the tabernacle opens out. The door to the tabernacle is always at the east side. So this, the Judah and those other two tribes are to camp here, and that's the privileged position. Next, on the south side, it's Ephraim, isn't it? Reuben. Reuben with Simeon and Gad. And they are going to be on the south side. So that's the next most privileged position. By the way, when they start marching, Judah will go first. Then Reuben is going to come second. Then the tabernacle, the Levites here, they are going to go in the third position, but they are not listed as having a position in the rankings here. Then next, in the third position is at the west, so they're out here, that's Ephraim. Ephraim and the other two tribes, Benjamin and Manasseh. So those are in the west side. So the only one left is the north. That's the least privileged. They're going to go last. And the north side is Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. So that's the order in which they will march through. Judah will go first, Reuben second, then come the Levites, and then Ephraim, and then Dan. Okay. By the way, it says each tribe will have a standard. By Jewish tradition, that standard would have been the color of the stone on the high priest's breastplate that was assigned to that tribe. Each tribe, there are 12 stones on the breastplate of the high priest, and each stone had the name of one of the tribes of Israel carved in it. And so according to Jewish tradition, the standards that were set up in the camp for each tribe corresponded to the color of that stone on the high priest's breastplate. Also, according to tradition, well, we see in Joshua 3:4, God instructed that that the tribes stay 100 yards from the Ark of the Covenant as they marched across the Jordan. And so it is understood that by tradition, they were supposed to stay 100 yards from the ark as they marched, progressed through the wilderness, through the desert. Okay, last section, chapter 2. These are the numbered men of the sons of Israel by their fathers' households, the total of the numbered men of the camps by their armies, 603,550. The Levites, however, were not numbered among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Thus the sons of Israel did according to all the Lord commanded Moses. So they camped by their standards, and so they set out, everyone by his family, according to his father's household. So they did as they were told to do, followed the instructions, and the camp has now been put in good order, with the tabernacle in the center, and everything else is placed with respect to that. I think it's interesting. We have no indication that there was any order before they get to Sinai. But now we have the tabernacle built. Now there's something around which everything can be organized and ordered, and that's what happens. Okay. There are just a couple of comments that I want to make about these first two chapters in general. The first is the description of the camp and the march matches exactly to the Egyptian pattern when the Egyptian armies went on expedition at approximately this time period, that is during the time period of Ramses II, which is around 1200 BC. Joshua Berman wrote a series of articles where he talks about that, and he shows all of the correspondences between the way this camp is described and how it fits with the way that the Egyptian camp was organized during the time of Ramses II. during that period of time, Ramses had a tent that went with them on the expedition, and in that tent was an idol to one of the Egyptian gods. I don't remember which one. It was the same color as the tabernacle was, red. And around that were his, I can't remember exactly what's right around it. I think its officers are right around it. And then the others are outside of, the other soldiers are outside of that, but it's in a rectangle. The other countries, when they went on expeditions, they had different arrangements, but the Egyptian arrangement matches this exactly. And so Joshua Berman makes the argument that this reflects Egyptian culture at the time that it is said that the Exodus took place. So it matches, it makes sense that they would use that pattern. And that Ramses was right in the middle of it in the same way that now Yahweh is right in the middle of it. Yahweh is their king leading them on this military expedition. So he argues, clearly this is a group of people that is heavily influenced by Egyptian culture of the time that it's purported to happen, the 1200s. Second thing I'd like to point out is God has just made a covenant with them. They have just celebrated the fact that God is in their midst. And as you'll recall, my understanding of Exodus, that Exodus builds to that celebratory ending that we have where God is now with them and they are now doing what God has asked them to do. Everything is the way it should be. But now in Numbers, we start out with a census getting ready for military conflict. Doesn't that fit? I mean, isn't that the way God does things? There's hardly time to celebrate a victory before the next trial comes along. That's what life is. It's one trying circumstance after another with very few breaks in between. So it's fitting. As soon as God is done speaking with them on Mount Sinai, now he says, get ready to fight. There are trials coming, and as we will see, there will be. Once they start moving, the trials come. The third thing I want to point out is there is no other book in the Old Testament that talks more about the Levites. Even Leviticus doesn't talk as much about the Levites as Numbers does. So we get a clearer picture of who the Levites are. And that's something that we want to be paying attention to, is trying to figure out who are the Levites and how are we supposed to think about them. It is curious, and I don't know what to make of this, but in Genesis 49, 5 through 7, when Jacob is proclaiming his blessing on all the tribes, all of his sons, the blessing that he proclaims on Levi is not a favorable blessing. As you will recall, it was Levi and Reuben that attacked. Okay. After a group of some men from a village raped Dinah, then it was Levi and Reuben that went in and killed a bunch of those men. Because of that, Jacob does not give a favorable blessing to Levi. What do we make of that? Jacob doesn't give a favorable blessing to them, and yet the Levites enjoy a privileged position in the life of Israel. How do you put that together? Also, they receive no inheritance in the promised land. The other tribes all do, but not the Levites. And how do we think about that? That's on the one hand. But on the other hand, Moses and Aaron are from Levi. And in Exodus, and we'll see that the same thing happens in Numbers, the staunchest defenders of Yahweh are the Levites. That happened after the golden calf, and we'll see that happen in Numbers as well. And as I said, they are given a special role in the life of Israel. So we're going to want to pay attention to who the Levites are and try to sort out how do we put these different clues together in understanding how are we to think about that particular tribe, that unique tribe. Okay. I went over, so it's probably best to just let you go. If you have questions, remember them for next week, and I will be glad to try to answer them next week. Thanks.